And now the Talk of the Nation opinion page. Neoconservatives include some highly influential people: Norman Podhoretz, Jean Kirkpatrick, Richard Perle, Paul Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, William Kristol, and Robert Kagan, scholars, intellectuals, editors, and sometimes public officials who embrace to a greater or lesser degree the label neoconservative. Nowadays, neocon has become an epithet linked especially to Iraq. But what neocons actually believe, where they come from, and what they did is a matter of some debate. Jacob Heilbrun, senior editor of National Interest and author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons, wrote a piece for the op-ed page of the Washington Post yesterday debunking what he calls five myths of the nefarious neocons. If you'd like to talk about the neocons' past or future role in shaping and executing policy, our number is 800-989-8255. Email talk at npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blog of the nation. Jacob Heilbrun joins us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks, Neil.
And let's go to the most provocative issue first. David Brooks famously quipped that the con is short for conservative and neo is short for Jewish.
Yes, that was an attempt, I thought, to portray the neocons as victims of anti-Semitic slurs. And Brooks, in my view, went too far. The neoconservative movement, I try to show in my book, is influenced by memories of the Holocaust and seeks to safeguard what it sees as Israel's security. They don't see any disjunction between American and Israeli interests. But it is true that some people have gone on to accuse the neoconservatives, which I call a myth, of being the lackeys of the Israeli government.
And how are they? How does that myth work?
That myth has primarily been propagated on the right by Patrick Buchanan, and he contends that the neoconservatives are in effect agents of Jerusalem and that they have subordinated American national security interest to Israel's.
You also write another myth that you write about is that neocons are chastened liberals who have turned to the right.
I believe there's some truth to that, but it's been wildly exaggerated. William Kristol was never a liberal. Norman Podhoretz was on the radical left and was not a liberal. And Irving Kristol was a former Trotskyist who believed that the United States was as dangerous as Nazi Germany during World War II until he went to fight in 1944. So the movement has a very curious history. But I think one of its distinguishing characteristics has been its attempt, its hostility to liberalism. In my view, it's more about hatred of liberalism than it is love of conservatism, which is why it's a somewhat anomalous group within the Republican Party.
It was also a somewhat anomalous group at one time within the Democratic Party. A lot of neoconservatives came out of Henry Scoop Jackson's office, a Democratic senator from the state of Washington, used to be laughingly called the senator from Boeing. But there were a group of people who worked for him who later changed parties and became identified with the neoconservatives.
That group includes Paul Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, and perhaps most prominently Richard Perle. That gets at one of the peculiarities of the movement is that it is in some ways, a heretical offshoot of the Democratic Party that turned on the Democratic Party and became frustrated by what it saw as the appeasement-minded left that had taken over the party in the wake of George McGovern.
The neocons had too much power and took over Bush's brain.
Well, that's another myth. In my view, it's clear from their own perspective that the neoconservatives ultimately had too little. They had no cabinet positions in the Bush administration. And once the Iraq War went south, many of the major figures that we associate with neoconservatism, such as Paul Wolfowitz or Douglas Feith, left the administration. And today it is Condoleezza Rice who seems to be setting the pace on foreign policy.
Another myth you describe as the neocons are bloodthirsty ideologues trying to impose a militant Wilsonianism on the United States that is alien to our foreign policy traditions.
Correct. I thought that that was also a falsehood. If we look at the Clinton era, it is in fact many of the liberal hawks who share some culpability for the current disaster in Iraq. It was hubris over the belief that American air power could simply be deployed cleanly as it was in the Balkans, and that Iraq would be a replay of this. This is why both the neoconservatives...
Well, they never sustained an air war on Iraq, anything like they sustained in Kosovo.
No, they didn't. But I think what animated both the liberal hawks and the neoconservatives was the idea that the U.S. was stopping had stopped genocide in the Balkans and would again topple another tyrant, Saddam Hussein, who to them was another Slobodan Milosevic. Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, this idea that they were solidly behind the intervention in Iraq, among the intellectual authors of the invasion of Iraq, that seems indisputable.
Yes, I think that they had. I think that President Bush was eager to topple Saddam Hussein even while he was on the campaign trail in 1999. It was the events of 9/11 that gave the neocons their opening. They had a blueprint for how to essentially package and sell the Iraq war to the American public, which Bush then adopted.
Mm. And finally, your fifth myth that you write about is that the Iraq debacle has discredited the neoconservatives.
Yes. When I was writing the book, I thought I was worried that the neoconservatives would be a spent force by the time it appeared. But
you'd be writing history and not a book of topical interest.
Exactly. But John McCain represents a lifeline for the neoconservatives, in addition to the own network of institutions that they have. But McCain, in my view, is in all but name a neoconservative. He enunciates the same foreign policy stands that William Kristol is in the New York Times every week, which is that we need to crack down on Iran and maintain the fight in Iraq.
Our guest is Jacob Heilbrunn. He's a senior editor at the National Interest, author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. He's with us here in Studio 3A. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also go to our website at npr.org. And there's a link to Jacob Heilbrunn's op-ed page piece in the Washington Post yesterday. Let's get a caller on the line. This is Ron. Ron with us from Charlestown in Rhode Island.
Yeah, hi. I just was thinking about David Green's book, Words as Weapons, where he sort of uses all these political terms, conservative, liberal, neocon, all that stuff, and sort of demonstrates how they get redefined over history. And so when I hear all this, like liberalism and whatnot, it's sort of like you're just talking about plastic that goes back and forth. And, you know, I mean, you could see that John McCain, he's the real conservative, but then you have other people saying, oh, he's no conservative at all. He's a liberal, and so, you know...
I think crypto-liberal is about as far as they'll go, but yeah.
Yeah, you know, and, you know, I guess it's a little frustrating when you hear the rhetoric or these labels sort of getting argued or, you know, sort of tried to be defined as something that's concrete when actually it's... I think these labels get redefined as they're needed and wanted, and I can take my comments off the air.
Okay, Ron, thanks very much. Is there an accepted definition of neocon?
Well, neocon, the definition has changed. It began as someone who was a member of the Democratic Party and had turned on it. Today, with the younger generation of Robert Kagan and William Kristol, they have not had the experience of ever being on the left. So, yes, these terms are malleable. And the latest generation has taken a much more hawkish stand on foreign policy of militant Wilsonianism than the older generation ever did.
Let's get Mike on the line. Mike with us from Berkeley, California.
Yeah, well, the last two conversations have more or less stolen my thunder. I think the term is has become so malleable that, speaking as a person who has called himself a neocon since before the term actually became popular, I don't recognize myself at all in the things that are now being called neocon. I remember it was an objection to the soft on communism of the post 1968 Democratic Party. It was an objection to the affirmative action, and it was a specific statement that we were not the typical socially conservative people as represented by William F. Buckley. And so, and my view is that the movement was totally successful in its biggest goal, which was to bring down the Soviet Union. I agree that since it has been so successful, there have been confusion and problems in as to even who should be called what. But again, I agree that the previous callers and the conversation have taken basically my point, which is that the term has become totally meaningless now and is simply an epithet in the hands of people who want to use it for their nefarious purposes.
And Jacob Heilbrunn, you point out that the epithets fly just as much from the right as they do from the left.
That is correct. The Pat Buchanan, William F. Buckley Jr., and George F. Will all view the neoconservatives with horror and antipathy. For them, the neoconservatives don't represent prudent conservative ideals, but instead a Trojan horse that has smuggled in liberal ideas about nation building into the Republican Party.
Yes, I think that the issue is that, and I think Pat Buchanan, unfortunately, is representative of this. These are some paleo conservatives who indeed dislike the many of the neoconservatives' lack of social conservatism. And if I may say so, I do think that there is an anti-Semitic tinge to the critique of the neocons now in terms of using it simply as an epithet.
Mike, thanks very much for the call.
Off the air.
All right, bye-bye. We're talking with Jacob Heilbrun about his op-ed piece that ran in the Washington Post yesterday, Five Myths About Those Nefarious Neocons. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get Jennifer. Jennifer with us from Norman, Oklahoma.
Hi. I'm wondering to what extent your guest found any neoconservative obsession with quote-unquote civilizational conflict a la Samuel Huntington's Class of Civilization, the Muslims are coming to get us, Muslims are going to, as they say, outbreed white people in Europe, and what role does he find that playing? I mean, people are talking about, anti-Semitism in reference to attacks against neoconservatives, but it seems that a lot of neoconservatives seem to be very anti-Semitic when it comes to people who are of Arab descent.
I'm afraid that many neoconservatives, while I wouldn't call them anti-Semitic, have gone down a very ugly road in discussing the presence of Muslims in Europe. And I think it's most concretely exemplified in Norman Podoritz's recent bestseller, World War IV, in which he describes an American war against the totalitarian Islamo-fascist movement.
Islamo-fascist,
right,
has pretty much been roundly discredited as a meaningless term itself.
Well, I think it's an absurd term because there is no totalitarian, there is no coherent Islamo-fascist movement that's being directed by one person such as Osama bin Laden. We know that it's a fairly disparate group of terrorists who sometimes interact and other times don't, which is one of the reasons that they're so difficult to pin down. But yes, the neocons have very much gone down the road of trying to create a new Manichaean movement, a new Soviet Union, a coherent force that menaces America and that illiberals are unwilling to acknowledge even exists.
Mm-hmm. And again, that should be some neocons, not necessarily all of them.
Not all of them, but I think this is going to be a very prominent theme in the 2008 election. Mitt Romney's comment about bowing out of the election or the run for the presidency because he didn't want to aid the terrorists is to me very threatening and very significant. And I don't think the full import of it has really registered with the American public.
Jennifer, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Dan. Dan's with us from Harper in Michigan.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to say that I'm sitting here staring at the Statement of Principles dated June 3rd, 1997, Project for the New American Century, signed by Elliot Abrams, Jeb Bush, Dick Cheney, Elliot Cohen, Stephen Rosen, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, Dan Quayle, on and on. I'm sure your author's familiar with this. One of the things I don't understand is in 4 years of a war, why have I only heard it mentioned twice on NPR? And I just want to say, even though the neocons are now out of the picture in the administration, the names I just read were at the top of a lot of his cabinets. Oh, let's throw in Mr. Libby, too. They were the ones who propagated this idea of preemptive war. It's right here. If you go through this document very carefully, they thought that, you know, something catastrophic happening like Pearl Harbor, it's in this document too, happening might allow these kind of ideas to happen in the future. At that time, they couldn't because people thought they were nuts. I just want to say that these people are the ones who gave them the idea for this preemptive war idea, and when 9/11 happened, it was a perfect excuse. So people need to take a look at this document, see the people who signed it in 1997, and they can draw their own conclusions.
All right, Dan, let's get a response from Jacob Heilbrun.
Well, the caller is 100% correct. As I tried to argue before, the blueprint was there for the war in Iraq. The surprising thing to me, which I talk about in my book, isn't that the Iraq War occurred, but if it had not occurred, it was overdetermined, to use a political science term. And Bush was in, we know from right after the 9/11 attack, a day or two later, he went to Richard Clark, who was then working on his national security staff, and said, find out about Iraq. And Clark said, we've studied this. We see no tie between Iraq and Osama bin Laden. And Bush said, find out.
But you also argue in this op-ed piece that some of the people that Dan just mentioned are neoconservatives, and others, including Vice President Cheney and President Bush himself, are not.
That is correct. I think Bush has actually become more of a neocon, a de facto neocon, as I call him, than Cheney himself. Cheney and Rumsfeld were not ever really interested in Iraq as a country. They were not interested in democratization. Rumsfeld and Cheney both wanted to demonstrate that the United States could act with impunity as a great power after the Soviet Union had vanished. So they figured Iraq would be a demonstration shot. We would go in, take out Saddam Hussein, and perhaps, in Cheney's view, trigger a wider democratization in the Middle East.
Neo-unilateralists.
Exactly. Then.
Okay. Jacob Heilbrun, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks.
Jacob Heilbrun, a senior editor of the National Interest and author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. He joined us in Studio 3A today. And again, you can find a link to his op-ed on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.